Welcome to another episode of Eric's Perspective. Joining me today is my lovely wife, Kelly Vlahakis-Hanks, president and CEO of Earth Friendly Products, makers of Ecos. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
I thought we'd start first just by explaining what you do now, and then we'll dip into how you got to where you are now, where you got started, and your love of art and so forth. So tell us a little bit about Earth Friendly Products and Ecos.
Well, great. My favorite subject matter outside of African-American art. So president and CEO of Ecos, as you said, we make 200 plant-powered household cleaning products. We manufacture our products in 4 geographically diverse manufacturing facilities. So we have facilities in Illinois, in Washington, here in California, in New Jersey. Just launched our 5th facility about 2 years ago in Greece. All of our facilities are carbon neutral, water neutral, and platinum zero waste. We're really proud of the fact that we're the only nationally distributed green brand in the country that's run by a woman, that more than 50% of our executive team is helmed by women. We have a really diverse group of leaders in the company, and that's been a big part of our success. We're now the number one selling green laundry detergent in the world. And I'm super proud of what we've accomplished, being family owned and operated, and really building a company that's both socially and environmentally responsible. And for me, that's been important throughout my entire life, to really do something that I passionately believe in, something that really speaks to my heart, and something that can truly make our world a better place. And I feel just so fortunate and blessed to be able to lead a company that's really dedicated to the preservation of planetary health and human health, and at the same time to really champion change. I think there's a powerful role that business can take in really being a leader at the forefront of raising the wages in our country and advocating for better policies for employees, and especially as this election approaches, even more important than ever before that business really take a stand. So that's what I do, and really just thrilled to be able to share my love of the planet that we all inhabit together in the work that I do.
And I imagine plant-based cleaning products is especially appropriate now given the current pandemic situation.
It really is. I mean, there's been no more important time to really discuss cleaning products and their importance in terms of human health. And so I feel very lucky that I've had a chance to really speak at a national level about how to best protect ourselves from COVID. And really, cleaning products are the number one weapon in the war on COVID. But as we're cleaning our homes, we need to make sure also to think about our long-term health as well. And I just don't want the pendulum to swing too far where people are really using toxic, corrosive cleaning products and not thinking about their implication for their health. And it's really not just about what we put in us and on us, but it's what's around us every day. And so really speaking to people about that component, that cleaning products matter. They matter for your health. You drink out of your glass and your cup. You eat off of your plate. And so those ingredients are entering our body oftentimes faster than what we put into our own mouths. So as we're trying to protect our families from COVID, it's important to clean. But it's also important to look for a safer way to clean. And I really just want to be transparent, to empower people, to educate people, to ask for people to actively read the ingredients on cleaning products. There is nobody who's actively policing cleaning products. So you yourself need to look at the labels, read the ingredients, and make sure to support brands that are truly doing the right thing for their consumers.
And I think it's also important to point out the company you've been leading for the last, what has it been, maybe 6 years or more, started in the late 1960s. So it's nothing new. In terms of the company, that is, it's been around for a while.
That's exactly right. You know, we've been committed to protecting people and the planet for over 53 years and creating green products for over 53 years. My father started the company in 1967, coming to this country from Greece, living in homeless shelters, and starting in his garage in 67. And he has an amazing life story and journey. But from the moment of the inception of the business, he was always trying to look for ways to green the process, really inspired and motivated by his childhood in Greece and growing up with his mother and seeing her use natural things to clean, like vinegar and lemon and oranges, and wondering why we were using so many dangerous chemicals in our cleaning products here in the United States. And so I look back on that history and his pioneering vision, and I'm just so proud that so long ago he had that foresight. And although we lost him, as you said, 6 years ago, I'm really proud to continue that vision and that mission.
So there's something about you that probably a lot of people don't realize, and that is you also have this deep and abiding interest in art. Can you talk about how that got started?
Absolutely. So I grew up in a really small town in Illinois, town of 3,000 people. And from an early age, I loved history. I loved culture. I was always really hungry to understand more about where I was from and my ancestral legacy. And so when I had the opportunity to go to UCLA in the mid-90s, I was thrilled. And the first thing I did in my history major was really select classes that were either about Greek history or African-American history. And I did study abroad programs in Greece and in Africa, really understanding the fact that if we know where we came from, it really gives us so much power for where we're going, and wanting to really understand the rich cultural heritage that my ancestors came from. And so it was a great journey at UCLA. And during my tenure there, I had the great fortune to have a wonderful professor, Professor Paul von Blum. And I know he was one of the first guests you had.
Yes, he is a previous guest. And I just also want to highlight the fact that, by the way, you have a combination of Greek ancestry and African-American ancestry, just to kind of clarify that. So, yeah.
That's
and, of course,
right.
Paul was a guest on it.
That's right, yes. So my father was from Greece, from the island of Crete, and my mother African-American. And so growing up just with a love of both parts of my heritage, and not really having that opportunity to explore them so much in a small town in the Midwest, and oftentimes feeling like the history books really sanitize the history, and I couldn't get really the true story. And so when I got to UCLA, taking all of these classes, I had the good fortune of signing up for one of Paul von Blum's classes. And I joke that afterwards, I sort of minored in Paul von Blum because I took 10 more of his courses during my tenure at UCLA. And the reason I loved his courses so much was that he utilized art to teach history. And in particular, his specialty was African-American art. And he utilized that medium to teach so many important stories. And it was so engaging and enlightening and invigorating. And I passionately connected to the works of art that he was showing in his courses, and really just fell in love with it. And so throughout the rest of my academic journey at UCLA, I always looked to take classes where professors were utilizing not just the textbooks, but they were utilizing film and literature and art, because once again, so often in our textbooks, we're not getting the real history. But one of the things that artists did was they utilized their paintbrushes as a tool or even as a weapon to really depict what was really going on, their real experience. And then we, as the viewers, have a chance to learn when we really listen to what the artwork has to say to us. And so took all of those classes at UCLA. And then my senior year at UCLA, I studied abroad in Africa, and in particular in South Africa, and did a lot of work on the apartheid and what was happening in South Africa. And when I came back, there was an opening at the California African American Museum. And it was an opening under an amazing African American artist, John Riddle. And it was an exhibition about Peter Magubane, calling Deconstructing the Apartheid. And so when I got back, Paul von Blum said to me, there's this position that's open at the museum just in time for your graduation. I would love to write you a letter of recommendation. And so my very first professional position was at the California African American Museum.
And what was that like? How did you adjust to working working in the California African American Museum?
I absolutely loved it. It was riveting work. It was work that I was extremely proud of. And the opportunity to work with so many amazing local artists here in Los Angeles, as well as working on this exhibition about Peter Magobani. And so John Riddle was a very active and prolific artist who had created such an amazing visual repertoire. And I was learning from him all the time as I had the chance to work under him at the museum. And being able to bring that exhibition to light at the California African American Museum and have everybody really understand what had happened during the apartheid in South Africa. Because I think too often we get, okay, you know, everything's fine now, you know, some years have passed, but really understanding that all of those underpinnings were still in play as well in South Africa. And obviously it was during my tenure at the California African American Museum that I had the great fortune of setting up a panel discussion and inviting who was definitely the top gallerist in the United States to speak on that panel discussion, and that was you.
Yeah, I remember that specifically. Yeah, it was a great, great opportunity. And we should say before we leave the Peter Magobani thing, he was a photographer, and a lot of the photographs that ended up in the exhibition had to be smuggled out of the country. Isn't that true?
Absolutely, because, you know, oftentimes people don't want the real stories told. And so artists are capturing the real stories, whether it's through paint or whatever medium they're working on, and especially photography, right? The actual depiction of what was occurring. And that oftentimes went against the narrative that they wanted to spin in the global press. And so really, Peter Magobani risked his life and utilized his camera as a weapon to fight against the system and to let the world know about what was happening in South Africa, what was really happening. And those images galvanized movements across the globe. It inspired people to action. You know, you think of it even today, right? As we sit here today, I think we all were so heartbroken as we sat and we saw the video footage of what happened to George Floyd. Mm-hmm. Those 8 minutes and 46 seconds riveted an entire nation as we saw a horrific lynching occurring on the video. And so you saw, you know, Black Lives Matter and so many protests and so many changes coming about because we saw what happened. And that's what Peter Magobani did. He made sure that we as a world saw what happened.
Yeah, exactly. And so going back to the panel discussion, as I recall, was it about Palmer Hayden? Or Palmer Hayden. So I was the exclusive representative at the time for the Hayden estate, and that was an interesting opportunity to address different questions and talk about Palmer Hayden, Harlem Renaissance painter, and kind of an interesting figure from a small town in Virginia, not far from where my mother was born. But that was also the chance for us to meet. And then eventually we started dating. And then next thing you know.
But not just yet. Not just yet.
Oh, she's gonna reveal a few secrets here.
Not just yet.
So. Okay, go ahead. Tell the story. Go ahead.
So anyways, after working at the California African American Museum and having the chance to meet so many great members of our community like you, I went on to work for a few other companies in various fields. And about 2 years after leaving CAM, I got word that John Riddle had passed away. And it was such devastating news because he was an amazing mentor. He was an amazing curator at CAM. He was a great visual artist and a really dear friend. And so when I had found out that he had passed away, I reached out to his widow, Carmen, and I just asked her if there was a possibility that I could purchase a work of his art because I wanted to make sure that my home ultimately reflected the things that I loved and I cared about. And certainly he captured in so many of his works things I was passionate about, and I just wanted a piece of that in my home. And she told me that Eric Hanks at M. Hanks Gallery was exclusively handling all of John Riddle's artwork. And so I then came to the gallery and I purchased the work that's here to the right of me.
Yeah.
In the early part of 2002.
That's right. Along with another piece by him as well, as I recall.
I did. And so when I purchased Clubs is Trumps by John Riddle, I then signed up for the art appreciation classes that you were teaching at the gallery. And missed the first class.
Very disappointing, I tell you.
To which you called and said, we missed you in class today. And I was there on the next class. And shortly thereafter, we started dating.
Yeah.
18 years ago.
Wow. time flies. But that's a great piece that you ended up getting, and as is the other one as well, yes. A theme that he explored quite a bit. But John Riddle, I just have to say, at the time of his death, it came as a shock to everybody. I mean, nobody expected him. It wasn't like he was laid up in the hospital with a terminal illness or anything like that. And so it came as a shock to everybody. But we were actually planning a solo exhibit in our gallery of his work. And he was actually producing for the show at the time of his death. So it was really sad in multiple ways. But he was a beautiful person on top of everything else, and he sorely missed. That was in 2002 when he passed away.
It was. I can still remember, like yesterday, going to the Watts Towers to the services in his honor. And there were services held all throughout Los Angeles.
And in Atlanta, because he lived for a time in Atlanta as well. And every single memorial service was standing room only. Keep people away out because it just wasn't enough room for everybody. It's a testament to how popular and respected he was.
Really, absolutely. I mean, I remember sitting with him to write the catalog for this particular piece over here when the artwork was displayed at the Stella Jones Gallery in Atlanta. And, you know, I think that John's loving presence and he was the father of six children. He was somebody who passionately cared about the world and his community and wanted to do everything that he could for aspiring artists, for artists that wanted his guidance or his mentorship, and to really serve as somebody who didn't let us forget our history and where we came from. And I loved seeing all of the love in the room, certainly that surrounded him. I certainly still miss him till today, which is why I'm glad that, you know, throughout the hallways of our home, you see a lot of his works, you know, works that, you know, there's one behind me here that really shows, harkens back to Africa and ancestral roots. I mean, John always talked about the fact that on the passage over, the slave ships came to our country and so much was lost during those passages. So many lives were lost. And then when the slaves arrived here in the United States, there was such a concerted effort to separate them from their history, from their culture, and to really get rid of all of those things. Yet the resistance was really in keeping those things alive in their artwork. You know, behind you right here, you have, you know, the Sunflowers Quilting Bee at Arles. But when I think about quilting in general, quilting was a way, you know, although quilting wasn't pervasive in Africa at the time, here in the United States, they were able to take those African motifs and those themes and those history and put them into the quilts that they were creating, mm-hmm. and really utilizing the fabric of the quilt to tell the fabric of their history. And I know for me, you know, being of Greek and African American descent, it's very easy on the Greek side to go back to Greece, to know where my family is from, to be able to experience that history, that culture. You know, Greece is oftentimes revered in West as the cradle of Western democracy, and you know, you can read about it in our history textbooks and celebrate it. But then on the African side of my heritage, I oftentimes couldn't get that same connectivity because I couldn't identify easily where in Africa had my ancestors come from. And right. So, you know, finding works of art to really create that link became so important to me.
Yes. And you were pointing out that piece that's behind me. That's actually by Faith Ringgold. And it's kind of a fantasy gathering of all these different historical figures, women. And then also in the background there, there's Vincent van Gogh. And one of his favorite themes was the sunflowers. So you got all the sunflowers, but you've got people like Fannie Lou Hamer and Rosa Parks and so forth like that sitting around the table. They were of different generations, so in reality, they would never sit around the table together, but Faith actually created this image. It started out as a quilt, and this is a serigraph that's behind me just to let everybody know what's going on. And quilts, as I found out later too, were used in the Underground Railroad as a way to communicate where to go to try to escape from slavery too. So it played a pivotal role in African-American history, quilts.
Absolutely. You know, I can only imagine what it would be like to sit there in the fields with them and to hear the conversations that so many of these amazing women leaders in the movement would be having. You know, I think it's been really important to me as a mother, to our daughter, to make sure that our home is surrounded with images of powerful women in our nation's history. I see Rosa Parks there. I can remember being, you know, a young girl in the school system, and when they taught the Rosa Parks history, they said, oh, she was a tired seamstress who just couldn't, you know, stand up. And then the Montgomery bus boycott happened. And so by doing that, they really took the power away from who Rosa Parks really was. Rosa Parks was the secretary of the NAACP, an officer of the organization. It was a well-planned out move. And so, and she was 42 years old. She wasn't an old, tired seamstress. I can remember in the late 90s meeting her when I was at UCLA and thinking, oh my goodness, she's still alive? Because certainly at the time, they had never portrayed her as the powerful female leader that she was. And so I think that, you know, having a home with images of these historical heroes and sheroes around us is also really important in terms of raising our daughter to be so proud of her ancestral legacy and who she is, and really developing a deep sense of self and a deep sense of pride. And it's an important reason for me that we have so much artwork on our walls.
Yes. And that's going to lead me into another question. So how do you think, having taken all those classes from Paul von Blum and explored the different aspects of art on your own and through museums, et cetera, how do you think that's helped shape you to be who you are now?
Oh, I think it's been of critical importance, and it's, you know, it's deepened my understanding. It's created a foundation to draw upon. It's inspired me. It's, you know, when I encountered Paul and his teachings and then went on to really explore African-American art and my great love of it. And actually, I didn't just work as a curator at CAM, but I also worked in the gallery scene in Los Angeles as well. I even did a show for Paul von Blum's daughter, Liz, who's an amazing artist as well. But for me, it just, you know, it inspires me when I wake up in the morning and I look at works of art like this, and I think about our history, and I think about what my ancestors have done so that I have the opportunities that I have today. It is something that gives me so much enthusiasm and power. I feel gratitude and appreciation for those that came before me. And I also feel like it just every single day serves as a reminder that we can really create the worlds that we want to create. And very much like an artist uses their paintbrush to show not only the past, but also the future, we can do the same through our work. Last year, when it was Earth Day, we commissioned an amazing artist to do a piece that we titled The Artist. And she painted a world that, you know, is unfortunately a representation of the world we currently have, with smog and pollution and, you know, a lot of the things that we're doing to destroy our environment. And then in the work, she painted side by side a piece of a world that she envisioned and the world that we want to create through what we do at ECOS and through, you know, the works that we do for the planet. And so it was just a 60-second video that we played at a lot of the film festivals and other things. But it was once again the idea of an artist using their paintbrush to paint, you know, what was, what is, and what we imagine. And that's a roadmap to follow as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, visual language, I think, is oftentimes so much more powerful than the written word. When you can see something, you know, you learn, you understand. I know for me, as someone who was learning in the classroom, the works of art spoke to me and resonated in a way that a historical textbook never could have. You read the pages and, you know, you study them, you memorize them, you regurgitate them, you take exams, you get good grades, but do you remember them? Do you feel them? Do you experience them? And when you learn history through art, you remember it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an experience created in this medium that stays in your mind. And I think it's one of the best ways for us to teach our youth. I mean, if I could advocate for changes changes in the curriculum, I would say that our children need to spend more time studying art and learning history through art to really develop a deep understanding of the past, much more than just reading words on a page.
Mm-hmm. What I find really inspiring is that you're a CEO of a company, and you got the company, you're running the company, but then you engage an artist to actually put on canvas a vision of what is and then also what ought to be, kind of a thing. So that's kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah, because, you know, for me, there's nothing more important in a company than really instilling the mission of the company into each and every one of our team members so we all understand what we stand for, what we're all working for every day. And that work of art, you know, which now hangs inside of our buildings, you know, is a visual reminder every single day that people come to work, that this is what we're coming to work for. We're coming to work for that, to leave that type of planet to our children. And art conveys that so quickly, and it really resonates with people. It touches their heart. It inspires them to action in a way that oftentimes words simply can't. And so I really think it's so important. I would love to see other businesses really think about how art can be an important backdrop in their organizations for really inspiring action, connectivity. You know, there's too many businesses I walk into that feel so sterile in nature. What do they stand for? What does everybody get together every day to work for? Mm-hmm. I think as human beings, being inspired and being surrounded by inspirational messages that aren't just words, but that are visual arts on the wall is so powerful. Mm-hmm. And I think more businesses should think of that. You know, as we now are where we are in 2020, and I think that there's been much more of an emphasis to think a little more about the Black experience in America. I've seen team members of ours come to me and just say, thank you so much for having that work of art or for sharing that story or for having that visual element on the wall so that they could learn, so that they could understand, so that they could connect, so that, you know, there was more compassion and empathy and all sorts of things created by having certain works around them.
So it's kind of a bridge building activity, basically, having the art.
It is.
Talking about.
It is.
Exposing it, hanging it on the walls and so forth.
Yes.
Are there any artists, we've talked about Faith Ringgold and John Riddle. Are there any other artists that stand out in your mind as artists that you really...
Oh my goodness. Absolutely. Well, there's so many different artists that I collect, and obviously we share the love of so many different artists and collect their work. But top of mind is certainly Phoebe Beasley. So Phoebe Beasley, I purchased a work from your gallery in the very beginning of a piece that Phoebe Beasley did called Mother to Son, a beautiful compilation between her artwork and the poetry of Langston Hughes. And I think Oprah Winfrey and others have talked a lot about her work.
Exactly. And not only that, I mean, it was Maya Angelou that actually chose the Phoebe Beasley, but also chose the poem and put the two together. So that was kind of very prestigious for Phoebe. And Phoebe's a wonderful, wonderful artist. Yeah.
She really is. And I think the only artist to get the presidential seal twice, right?
Twice, exactly. And she was a previous guest on this podcast as well. So, yep. So Phoebe Beasley, yeah, that's a...
And she's
still actively working. I just might shoot that right in there. She's still actively working and producing art.
I'm really thrilled. I'm also part of an organization with her called the Trusteeship. And so it's an organization compiled of, you know, women who are preeminent in their various fields. And so I've had the chance to spend a lot of time with Phoebe, and she's just such a wonderful person alongside of being such a wonderful artist. I also really love the works of Walter Williams. We have several of his pieces here in our home. And Walter Williams obviously had spent a lot of time in Denmark. So I think you could probably share his story even better than I could. But, you know, being at Fisk University and being involved in an interracial relationship was very challenging for he and his wife. And so they returned to her native Denmark, and they lived out a lot of his life there. But I love his artwork. Works of Denmark and of the beautiful fields there as well.
Absolutely. He was really famous for using children and flowers and butterflies and birds to express his optimism about the future of relations. I think for him, children were the hope for the future. And he kind of conveyed that. I mean, obviously in different paintings, he had a different point of view and a different focus. But primarily, I mean, that was kind of the hallmark of his work. And Walter ended up passing away in Denmark, became a Danish citizen, and he died in 1998. But yeah, his work is really fabulous.
Yeah, I can remember you going back to meet with his widow and his son.
Exactly. And his widow is still alive, by the way, just recently, about maybe a year ago now, met with her in Copenhagen. Wonderful person. She was very open. There's a show that I did some years ago, and she volunteered information about Walter that probably wasn't previously known, and we included it in the exhibition catalog. And it was very helpful in understanding who he was as a person and as an artist. So Walter, yeah, he's special to me too, so we're simpatico. Like,
yeah, and I think, you know, these scenes of nature that exhibit hope and optimism really resonate with me too. I mean, that's certainly what I'm trying to do with our company, right? So, you know, believing in a better world, believing in a brighter future, believing in a healthier planet, believing in healthier relations between people, believing in equality and all of these things. And so I really love the hope and the optimism. I think that's a very important message to put out. Yeah. Because we all have to aspire to something. We all have to see the beauty and to really go after it. And I love how he does that in his works of art. Another artist that I absolutely love is Michael Massenburg, who I think you had as well.
Who was a previous guest, Michael? Actually, I think his was the first that we showed.
And that was also the first gift you gave me, was a work that Michael Massenburg did called Peace of Mind. And that still hangs in our living room here. And just such a fabulous, fabulous piece, and such a wonderful artist. Other artist, George Evans, who's
another previous guest, and a good friend.
Yep. And so, I mean, their works are around our home all day long. And I love all of their works. They really do inspire me.
Excellent. So, you know, it's funny, a lot of people favor figurative art over abstract art. Some people, it doesn't matter. Some people favor figurative over abstract. Do you have any kind of preferences like that in terms of the art itself?
So, you know, I would say that not necessarily. You know, I think for art, you have to be really open and see if the piece speaks to you. I think so often people are hungry for, like, which art should I collect, and what's the best art, and is this better than that artist? Is this person? And in the end of the day, I think it's such an individual experience. You need to stand in front of that work of art, and you need to understand, does it connect with you? Does it resonate with you? So I think for sure, I'm really drawn to artists that are really painting our history, our narrative. And so in those cases, you know, like the work behind you, the Faith Ringgold piece, I mean, they really, really speak to me. But, you know, there's a Robert Cole Scott here just to my left that's much more abstract in nature and yet still really calls to me. I can see Africa in there. I can see things that he's trying to communicate. And I would advise everyone to be really open and to make sure that as you collect, as you curate your own exhibition, as you curate your own lives, select things that speak to you, that call to you, that talk to you, and to try and not be overly influenced by what others think of the work of art. And I think that happens often.
You know, as a gallery owner, and I've been at this for 30 some years now, I can tell you that a lot of people, unfortunately, are influenced by what they fear people might think if they end up collecting a work of art that somehow speaks to them and they really like. I even had a collector really admit that to me. It's very unusual that would happen, but it did happen. And I think that's excellent advice, though, to buy work that actually speaks to you. You're not influenced by what others might say about it, but it's more like, what is the artwork saying to you? I always advise people in my art appreciation classes, when they're looking at artwork, to use their eyes and, of course, their intellect and try to understand the piece on an intellectual level. But I think also try to feel the piece. Mm-hmm. You know, just take a few deep breaths and how does it make you feel? Sometimes if it doesn't make you feel any kind of way, I mean, that could be something that's said about it too. But if you feel, what emotions does it arouse in you? I think that's an interesting way to approach looking at works. And some of the statistics are kind of discouraging. I know it's been a while now, but it used to be a statistic that average person spends about 2 seconds looking at a work of art in a museum. And that's partly maybe due to the fact that a lot of museums are huge and you're trying to get through and see everything. But that's probably better, I think, as a person, on a personal level, I think, to just spend a little time with it and kind of feel it, get to know it. But so that's, I think it's good advice that you're giving as a collector yourself and as a person who looks at art and tries to understand it at the deepest possible levels.
It's interesting that you say 2 seconds in a museum. I mean, I think as someone in consumer products goods, we understand that the shopper in the grocery store spends 5 seconds, 5 feet away looking at a product. Right. So the idea that they would only give 2 seconds to a work of art is a real shame when they're spending 5 seconds to look at a laundry detergent.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, you know, it's important to really spend the time. You know, I am... As I took the art appreciation classes with you, and certainly, you know, the work that I did at CAM and at the art gallerist, the gallerist at the time, it was called Bodacious Backstreet Art Gallery, which some people here in Los Angeles might remember in the community. And working in those various things, you know, I worked with all different types of arts, different mediums, different artists, and learned so much from each and every one of them. So much great value, so much great takeaway as a person that I found in their works of art. And in the opportunity, you know, one of the things that I really love about Eric's perspective is the opportunity to hear from the artists themselves. You know, important to hear from people like me that are collecting it, but even more important to hear the artists' words and, you know, how they create their art and, you know, the messages that they're trying to convey. But oftentimes as a collector, you might take something from the artwork that they hadn't even intended, and that's okay too, because in the end of the day, you're going to bring your life experiences. You know, we all have a different journey on this planet. And so when we look at a work of art, all our experiences will oftentimes shape what we take from that work of art. And so it's important to allow that process to take place and then to really respond to it and to really, you know, go after those works that speak to you. I mean, art, like anything, it's an investment. And so you're investing in something that you want to really bring you joy and really enrich your life in a meaningful way.
And it's very important too, I think, to amplify what you just said, because art as an investment, a lot of times I get approached by people who, like, you know, you want the hot stock tip, you know, who's hot now, you kind of buy low and sell high kind of a thing. I think that's a kind of an unfortunate approach to the whole thing. But when you say investment, I take it in a different way. It's like you're investing not just the money, but yourself into it as well. You're trying to get something that reflects who you are, what you feel, and how you relate to the work. By the way, I think a lot of artists that I represent and have talked to over the years actually want that interaction to take place. They respect what the viewer brings to the table. And sometimes it's interesting for them as artists to understand what it is you see and how you interpret what they put on the canvas or in the sculpture or whatever it is. So I think that's really an important point, I think, to amplify. But I always caution people, listen, it's not up to me to decide why anybody collects art, but when you invest, you have to then, if you look at it from that point of view, I think you have to also take into a lot of the sort of hidden costs of investing in art. So for example, if you buy an older piece of art, you may have to have it conserved, and that could be an expense. You also have to insure the art over time. There's the opportunity cost of money that you have to consider. So all these things as a collector, if you're going to invest, you could have invested in some real estate, you could have invested in stock. You know, what would you have gained if you didn't invest in the art, if you're only looking at it from that point of view as an asset?
Right.
So, you know, again, everybody has their own reasons for collecting, and it's not up to me to dictate what you do and why you do it. But I do advise people to follow their heart, because the worst thing that can happen, you end up with a work of art that you absolutely love, and that can't be so bad, right?
That's exactly right. You know, you had asked me earlier about some of the artists that I really love, and I don't want to miss one that I really, really love, and that's Henry Tanner. Oh. And there's a wonderful piece of a grandfather teaching his grandchild to play the banjo. And
Banjo Lesson, which belongs to the Hampton University Museum collection in Virginia.
Such a beautiful piece. But, you know, the piece speaks to me on multiple fronts, right? You're showing the beauty of a family. But that same portrayal is also an act of resistance because you're defying the stereotypes that are so pervasive and so persistent about the relationship between Black men and their children and their grandchildren. And so I also think that art has such an important role to play in challenging stereotypes and bringing forth the real truths and really showcasing things that are so positive and so uplifting. And I think that, you know, that's also very important to have too around you in your space to really challenge narratives that really don't have a place, but that have continued to be perpetuated. And I love the fact that art can do that as well.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And it's interesting you say that too, because in the case of Henry Tanner, he did a few pieces. He's known really, his father was a bishop and a lot of his art, in fact, the vast majority probably is of a kind of a religious theme, but he did do Banjo Lesson and Thankful Poor, which feature...
And Thankful Poor.
Right, which feature an older Black man with his grandson or grandchild or whatever. But in his own words, he indicated the reason. And by the way, he painted those paintings in the late 19th century. It wasn't even the turn of the 20th century just yet. It was the late 1890s, mid to late 1890s. And he said in his own words, the reason for doing those paintings, and it was because he wanted to do, as you just got through saying, he wanted to have a antidote to the stereotypical images prevalent at the time of minstrels, demeaning, degrading, degenerate, you know, these really images that belittled Black people in general. And he felt it necessary to show a side of Black culture that wasn't being highlighted. In fact, just the opposite. It was just being overlooked, and he wanted to counteract that. So it's interesting you chose that piece to talk about, the Banjo Lesson, because it was important to him. The very thing you just said attracted you to the piece. So it's really interesting. There's art as a kind of tool to sensitize people mm-hmm. to a culture. And I think as long as all of us remain open to that possibility, and regardless of who the artist is, I think that's a positive thing. So that was great you brought up Henry Tanner, one of the great all times. Another expatriate artist, by the way, ended up leaving the country, and he's buried in Paris, an expatriate artist that ended up having to live the rest of his life out in France.
Yes, such a so unfortunate, but I'm so glad that we have his works and we get a chance to see those. I think it's so important for people to patronize African-American art institutions and galleries and other places to have the chance to see these amazing works. I've never had the chance to go to Hampton, and I'd certainly like to do that.
I would recommend everybody, by the way, Hampton University Museum has an incredible collection, including the Banjo Lesson you just mentioned, but all kinds of other wonderful works by some of the most well-respected African-American artists. And because it's African-American, doesn't limit the viewers to be African-American. Hopefully everybody, regardless of their own backgrounds, would be interested and check that out. And of course, the Howard University Museum has a respected collection. Fisk University, these are historically Black universities, mm-hmm. all of them, started right after the Civil War, all have interesting and very diverse collections of artwork. And then, of course, the newly opened museum,
Smithsonian
that you and I actually had the good fortune of seeing. They have a nice collection in their building. And it's more broad. It's beyond just art. It's other artifacts, et cetera, and so forth like that. But it's a way to get to know the culture.
And I think a lot of the museums now are doing a wonderful job of really creating interactive exhibits and exhibits where you really feel like you're part of the experience of the African-American journey here to the United States, that you get a real sense and a real feel for what exactly happened during the slave trade. You know, 100 million lives lost at sea. It's unfathomable what's happened. Yeah. But then you get a chance to understand the journey and then the American journey here as well. And I thought, you know, when Ken Chenault hosted the American Express opening there at the museum, and we had the chance to be there with Mark Ridley Thomas and so many other amazing people here from LA. It was a great experience to get a chance to see that museum. And I know that museum was 80 years in the works. And so having an African-American museum on the mall took a long time to really come to fruition. And people championed that museum from as early as 1940s. And so people should realize that it's the hard work after a lot of years to have that come to fruition.
Yeah, yeah. And just as a footnote, it's part of the Smithsonian. And now Lonnie Bunch, who actually was instrumental in starting that museum, is the head of the entire Smithsonian complex. It's all 19 Smithsonian institutions are under his leadership now. So that's also an interesting development. But it's something worth seeing for sure. And that's an interesting point too, by the way, bringing up the importance of supporting the museums by visiting them, which is a beneficial thing to you as the viewer, but to them as well. So, you know, because a lot of their value is measured in attendance.
Right. And I think now I love seeing on social media, on Instagram, and all of these pervasive platforms supporting Black businesses is really a big drive. You know, we see a lot of our retailers pledging to have 15% of the shelves with products that are made by Black-owned businesses. And at the same time, we have to think of all of the institutions that are purveyors of these amazing cultural artifacts, and we have to support those as well. And I think that, you know, oftentimes in a time period like this, when you face a great recession, arts are the first thing that get cut, and right. arts are the things that people say are not a necessity, but they're a true human necessity. And we as consumers have the power to make sure that arts stay a part of our curriculum, that these institutions survive and thrive during these downturns in our economy by making sure we show up and visit, you know, safely, distanced, with masks, but that we go out and we support these things that are so critically important, because these are the vehicles through which we tell our stories. These are the vehicles through which you can counter propaganda that is untrue. And if we don't leave those institutions intact, in whole, it'll be very sad when we come out on the other side and they're not there to be with us. So I certainly hope that people that love the arts and understand their great importance, not just for our children, but for ourselves, really patronize those things as well.
I think that's very good, especially as you mentioned, that we are in the middle of a pandemic. And so a lot of the museums, we were talking about this earlier off of the camera and the microphone, about how reduced capacity visiting and so forth like that, obviously for protection. But there's virtual visiting as well. So that's another way to, at least right now, to see what's in these different museums. But I think it's important to keep in mind that they're very important to us as a culture, and we should support them in any and every way possible.
I mean, we just had a chance to attend that wonderful exhibit where they had taken all of the signs from the protests, from the Black Lives Matter protests here in LA, and they collected the signs, and I think it's all been donated now to the California African American Museum. Right. But I think people don't realize, like, those historical relics are works of art. I mean, there's amazing artists who painted Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, right. and there's amazing artists who painted all sorts of scenes and, you know, painted the world that they wanted, painted the world that they didn't want, painted messages and took to the streets and utilized the sound signs as very powerful mediums to convey messages visually. And so it was a beautiful exhibition that we attended, and we got a chance to walk through the signs. And as you walk through the signs, they were hanging from the ceiling, you almost felt like you were weaving through the crowds in one of these protests that was demanding change. And I thought it was very, very powerful, and just reminds me of how important artwork continues to be in our everyday lives to really make change, to really tell our story, to really shape the narrative. It's so critical. And I really just hope people keep going out to see it.
Absolutely. And I think, too, you know, art and culture, it's really, I think, necessary for the morale of our society. It's kind of uplifting, and maybe sometimes not. Maybe it's more like shaking us awake from ideas that we held that we probably should reexamine. I mean, all kinds of different ways. Freedom of expression is an incredibly important thing in America, and I think art is one of the ways to exercise that freedom of expression. And having an audience take a look at, and you don't have to agree, I mean, but I think at least give a shot and take a look at what's out there.
And it's such a powerful tool, but such a peaceful tool as well, right? So when we're really focused on how can we communicate in a powerful way, but still do it peacefully, art is really that weapon. Art is really that medium in which we can accomplish that. Right. And so it's even more important than ever because of that.
I see that.
You know, I think of when you talked about uplifting, it brings to mind Bill Pajot's artwork too. So, you know, I love the scenes that he did. We have hanging down here in New Orleans, and he looked at funerals, which are one of the, you know, saddest moments in our lives, but he painted glorious images of, you know, the musicians coming out and playing at the New Orleans funerals and, you know, the celebratory nature of things. And so once again, it reminds us of hope. It reminds us of optimism. And he also really captured how important music is to our history and our narrative.
Well, you know, it's really interesting you bring that up because his father was William Pajot Sr. He actually was a trumpet player for a New Orleans jazz funeral band. And so that informs a lot of Bill Pajot's work, his son's work. And Bill Pajot, we should say, passed away in 2015. We miss him dearly. He was a wonderful watercolorist and painter using pastels and acrylics and so forth. But so music informed his work, not only in terms of subject matter, because he would present his father and his father's band, the Eureka Brass Band, but he would actually listen to music, and the music that he was listening to would help him convey what he was trying to convey on his on the paper and the canvas and so forth. There was an abstract painter that I represented for a while who also, in his case, it was like he was conveying the emotion. He would listen to, say, John Coltrane or Miles Davis. It's interesting to bring up this idea about music, but show you the interconnectivity of the arts. He would, whatever that emotion he was feeling from the music, he was transferring it to the canvas as he was painting it. And so that was an example of sort of putting music on canvas, making it visual. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an interesting approach. But that, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's an important aspect of culture and the cross-pollinization of these different media. And think about looking at a movie. If you ever look at a movie, look at it with the sound off and then look at it with the sound on. I mean, it's not just the words spoken by the actors, but there's music that helps to create the mood or the atmosphere that the director is trying to lay out. So the interconnectivity of the arts is something I think we should always keep in mind.
Absolutely. And I, you know, I also feel very fortunate just with your family. Obviously, the Cosby Collection is one of the greatest collections of African-American art in history. And so having the opportunity to go when the African Museum showcased it back in 2014, I think was also a wonderful opportunity to see the collection. But I know, obviously, you know, David Driskell has written a wonderful book called The Other Side of Color that certainly talks about their collection and talks about the wonderful pieces like the Tanner piece and others that they own in their collection. So I also feel like having the chance to spend time in their home and around their collection as well is something that's been a wonderful opportunity for me to continue to learn about so many of the great artists that are not always featured in our textbooks, that are not always part of the art classes that we take and the things that we read. You know, when I hear you talking about how he painted, like when he felt the music. I took many classes where, you know, we learned about Van Gogh working the canvas like he would work the fields and how he tried to really bring the canvas to life as if he was working in the fields. But too often the African-American artists aren't on the pages of those textbooks.
That's true, but I'm happy to say that that's slowly and maybe picking up a bit of pace. It's kind of changing, and that's a positive thing. More and more shows, The Soul of a Nation, traveled around the U.S. It's to me, a little bit ironic that it started in England, but nevertheless, it landed here in this country and traveled around, and I think a lot of people benefited from seeing it. It was here in L.A. at the Broad and started its life in the U.S. at Crystal Bridges in Bentonville, Arkansas.
A place I spend a lot of time in Bentonville, Arkansas.
You should say because
selling a lot of cleaning products.
Selling cleaning products.
to Walmart.
To Walmart, exactly.
But I must say, I mean, you know, I've been traveling to Bentonville, Arkansas for 15 years. And so, you know, you're going down there. You're obviously, in my case, pitching cleaning products to the world's largest retailer and truly thrilled about the fact that you can buy Ecos at Walmart. But, you know, visiting there throughout the years, there was oftentimes, you know, in terms of cultural opportunities and things to see and do, I felt very limited. And, you know, Arkansas, it's kind of like the Deep South. And when Crystal Bridges opened, it was, for me, such a transformative experience to be able to go there. And Alice Walton did such a beautiful job of really, you know, purchasing a lot of African-American artwork and having it on display in the walls of the, of the museum. And so I certainly make sure whenever I go to Arkansas to go to Crystal Bridges and see the beautiful collection of American artwork and making sure that, you know, African-American artwork has a prominent place in the institution is something I definitely appreciate.
You brought up David Driscoll's name, and I just wanted to highlight the fact that he was such a crucial figure in African-American art because he was an artist, but he was also a scholar and a teacher. And he played a pivotal role in sort of taking the baton from James Porter, who was his instructor at the University of, at Howard University, who himself was head of the art department there and an artist and a teacher and so forth, wrote a book about African-American art. And David Driscoll did the same thing, kind of carried on where he left off. So, and you mentioned earlier also Smella Lewis. These are figures that are very important to the foundation of our knowledge about African-American art. And they did so much to promote and educate us about the different artists and what they were up to. They deserve a whole lot of credit. But I'm happy to report there's so many more books about art. There was the first ever solo exhibit of a Black American artist was Romare Bearden at the National Gallery in Washington, D.C. some years ago. Big, beautiful, well-researched book that came as a result of that. These kinds of things really helped to bring to the awareness and consciousness of people of all backgrounds, and we all benefit from it. Things that we should really know and understand, I think.
You know, I think that if we could really, at this time period, think about ensuring that our youth get access to these types of publications. I mean, I think that's as a child growing up in a predominantly Caucasian town without these things being in the curriculum that I had. I think as parents, really being advocates and making sure that these types of books are really part of the curriculum for our children will give them so much pride, so much joy. They'll see themselves reflected in the pages of history. They'll see themselves powerfully reflected in the pages of history. And that is something that can really change a person's life.
Yeah. And that kind of reminds me earlier, you showed me, you did as an 18-year-old, an essay, and you quoted Alain Locke. I just, that jumped into my head when you were talking just now. And he wrote the book, The Negro in Art, predates a lot of books about Black American art. And so that kind of helps also form the foundation. It's a book that's worth looking up and checking out, but he was also a critical figure in African American art history. So,
right. And when I quoted him, I his quote about how understanding our past, there's nothing more galvanizing to a human being than understanding their past, was kind of the impetus of that quote that I'd included in my application to UCLA in the 90s, right? So right. It was something that really spoke to me back then. And I'm so glad that through my academic experience at UCLA, I could really explore that and take those classes and have Paul von Blum as a mentor and, you know, art as a form of political and social protest and African-American art and all of the things that they offered at the institution was just, it was wonderful. And the community outreach, I mean, the way they engaged M. Hanks Gallery and so many other, you know, really amazing institutions in the LA arts community with the program also made it such a rich experience too.
Excellent. Yeah. So Kelly, thank you so much for agreeing to speak with us on Eric's perspective. Really appreciate your comments and contribution and so forth. Thank you for joining us.